It was important to find the right people to paint them. I want to thank Sharon Sprung for capturing everything I love about Michelle. Her grace, her intelligence, and the fact that she's fine.
Former President Barack Obama with former First Lady Michelle Obama at yesterday's unveiling of their official White House portraits. It was the first time they were both there in the White House since they officially left in early 2017. President Obama's image was painted by Robert McCurdy, and Michelle Obama's portrait, as we just heard, was painted by Sharon Sprung. She is primarily known for her portrait paintings, and she has done portraits of Jeanette Rankin, the first woman elected to Congress, and Patsy Mink, the first woman of color elected to Congress. Sharon Sprung joins us now from Washington. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
Well, you're in Washington because you were in the audience there. What was that like, seeing your canvas finally unveiled?
I think the most exciting thing was seeing everybody walk in. You know, there's a big gap between when they walk in, the audience gets settled, and then they announce them, and then everybody just, for the Bidens and the Obamas, just stood up and cheered. And you could see that it was so heartfelt, and everybody was so happy to see them together. So that was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was a delay, right, to show the painting at this time, because when Trump was in office, he didn't want to have an official portrait unveiling of his predecessor?
That's correct. So it only took 5 years. So we only waited 5 years.
So in the meantime, where was the portrait? Because you had finished it, right?
I had finished it quite a while ago. So for most of the time, it was in Washington. They take the painting because they didn't really know what was going on either, I'm sure, or at least nobody told me. They get it framed and it's all ready to go when this happens. And then COVID hit. So that was another delay.
Mm. So it was somewhere in Washington this whole time.
Oh, I'm sure it was in storage.
Yeah, yeah. So it must have been nice to see it again after so many years for you.
It was a little startling, actually. I remembered it a little differently. So I want to see, as it comes and matures in the light, how it reacts to the light, because paint needs light. Oil needs light. Mm. So we'll see. Yeah, it was great.
Well, when you say startling, what had you remembered about it? And how was that different from what you saw yesterday?
I remember everything a little lighter. I'm used to seeing my work in a gallery where the lights are just right. Everything is perfect. So it makes a difference to me.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody else would notice it, but it was noticeable to me.
I'm sure you have a much more critical eye than most people, especially of your own work.
Yes, exactly. Especially my own work.
Well, let's hear what Michelle Obama had to say about your portrait.
Sharon, it was wonderful to work with you. You are a true spirit. That's one of the reasons why we connected. Your work is phenomenal, but it was your essence, your soul, the way you saw me, the way we interacted.
How did you interact? Describe what the process was like. Did she sit for your painting?
That's one the first time that I cried during this whole process, because I was so moved by what she said. I mean, of course, I felt that way, but who knows what the other person is feeling or saying. And she said it so beautifully. That really meant so much to me, because it's somebody that I respect so much. And the fact that she could say this after the portrait is done, that was incredibly meaningful to me.
Mm. So describe what that was like working with her. Because was it just the two of you?
No, you're never alone with Michelle Obama. it's a White House.
Well, aside from Secret Service, right?
Well, it's not only Secret Service. There are a lot of people around, you know. There are makeup, hair, friends. I don't know. Everybody that does some job there, they're always there. And you're not allowed to move furniture. I mean, there are much different restrictions than you when you work with someone in your own home or in their own home and take pictures. I had to get permission to move the couch in the red room into the blue room. And I just started to pick it up and move it like I would do in my studio. And that didn't work.
I'm sure that didn't sit well.
So when she sat on the couch, I sat next to her and said, Do you have any thoughts about the portrait? Because you don't have that much time with people that are so busy and public. And she said, you know, I really don't. I have had no time. And I think that was her tacit agreement that she picked me. She trusted what I did. And that is the greatest gift you can give an artist. And she gave me, I felt, was free rein.
Mm. And was it, did you paint it from a photograph, or did you paint it from her actually sitting there for hours?
No. Well, you can't bring oil paint into the White House. They just don't like it. It's like oil paint is a rash that sort of spreads around a room. So I'm sure they didn't want it anywhere near there. I went in, I did photographs, I did color studies that I brought in to show her and compare with her skin tones. And I got a lot of photographs of her, and I plastered my studio with them so I could get a sense of who she was and stay in that moment for the months that I painted it. So that's how you do it. And you just sort of pray that you connected with that person. And that's why it was so meaningful when she said that to me.
Hmm.
Or she said it to everybody, actually.
So when you were alone with her, her image and the painting as it was evolving, how did you get to know her better, I guess? Or how did you get to know her as a person rather than a public figure?
Well, that's such an interesting process because it's really an unconscious process. I'm not good at writing. I'm not really that good at talking. So I'm good at intuitively understanding people or being sensitive to them. Maybe it's not understanding. Maybe it's a certain sensitivity to people. And I certainly felt that for her. And then I went in the studio every morning and said hello to Michelle. I said, good night, Michelle. And, you know, we have a little feuding going on in the studio. And sometimes, you know, her lip would go in the wrong way, and I would just go, no, no, we're not doing this. So it's listening to the painting. And I always look at paintings of children, you know, like Michelle is a child, so that I have an understanding of what's a constant in her life. So that I could, in a couple of photos, I could see the little girl in the grown-up. And that was that's always important for me to capture, because that stays throughout.
And what did you see that was in her from when she was a child to now?
Well, first I saw this beautiful picture of this smiling young girl. I think she must have been maybe 4 or 6. And she's just there in the world, happy. And that's a great thing to see, and you want to carry that around. Not every child is like that. And then I saw one of her dancing ballet. She took ballet, I guess. And she was so determined in her face, and she has such grace and beauty that translated into the painting. And the fact that she took that pose, she held that sense of presence of her throughout it.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today and talking about your process and your painting of Michelle Obama. It's really a beautiful painting. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
It's Sharon Sprung, New York-based portrait painter who was commissioned to paint the official White House portrait of former First Lady Michelle Obama, which you can see at our website at kcrw.com. Coming up, how tennis is changing at the U.S. Open. Serena and Rafa are out. There's a new generation of superstars. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. This year's U.S. Open has had more storylines than an HBO drama. Novak Djokovic didn't play at all and faulted COVID vaccine requirements. Serena Williams said she was retiring but left the door slightly open for a return. A new crop of young players, including one American, is getting a lot of love for their epic play. Even the tennis balls are causing a racket among some players. Matt Futterman is a sports writer for The New York Times. Hi.
How are you today?
I am well. I spent a late night watching the Open last night. I guess if you were watching in New York, you were up till 3 a.m, right?
Not a great situation for the U.S. Open, believe it or not. As great as that match was with Carlos Alcaraz and Jannik Sinner, who are probably the two best prospects in the world for the game. People think they're likely to sort of have a rivalry that will be similar to what Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer had. It was kind of hidden from a lot of people. That's one problem with the U.S. Open. A lot of great things happen in the middle of the night, at least in the middle of the night, in much of the country.
Well, let's talk about that epic match last night. So Carlos Alcaraz, for people who don't know, he's what, 19 years old from Spain? Is he considered the new Rafa?
He's considered the new just big star. He would say he thinks his game is more similar to Federer in that it's at least, you know, when Rafa was his age, he was a very hard-hitting but also a very defensive player. And Alcaraz is really an all-court player. But yes, because of the Spanish connection, it seems like it's easiest for people to say, oh, he's the new Rafael right. Nadal, and he's an incredibly dynamic player and just an absolute marvel to watch.
Right. And so he eked out a win after how many hours of play?
I believe the final tally was about 5 hours and 15 minutes. And this is coming on the heels of another 5-set win that ended at something like 2 a.m. two nights before. So he's not exactly making it easy on himself. And like I said, this is a thing that happens in the U.S. Open. And there is a discussion to be had as to whether 5-hour, 5-set matches are, you know, a great thing for tennis or not such a great thing for tennis.
Right. So he will play Francis Tiafoe. Tell us about him.
Francis Tiafoe is a kind of miraculous story. He's 24 years old. He's been around for a little while in that 3 years ago, he made the quarterfinals of the Australian Open. He's the son of immigrants from Sierra Leone. And really the only reason he's playing tennis is because his father was a janitor in a local tennis club that just happened to be one of the really, really good centers for developing young players in the country. And he was, as a little kid, he, you know, spent time hitting balls against the backboard there. And people noticed that he had some talent and he was sort of brought into the program. And by 10 years old, he was down in Boca Raton in development camps with the USTA. And he's been on a really good trajectory for the most part ever since. He slumped a little bit in the last, 3 years ago after that Australian Open burst. But he's been on a really good trajectory the last 2 years.
So he will play Alcaraz in the semis. He's 24 years old, so I guess the old man in that match. Is there a favorite going into that one?
Well, I think, you know, just by their seeding, you'd have to say that Alcaraz is something of a favorite. But, you know, Tiafoe has beaten him. He's fearless right now. He's playing the best tennis of his life. And he has, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 23,000 friends in Arthur Ashe Stadium at his beck and call throughout his matches. And he knows how to use a crowd. He's a showman. He's one of these athletes who was just born for bright lights. Even when he wasn't playing this great, he loved the big stage. He loves a crowd and he really plays to it. And, you know, the noise in there, as we saw last week when Serena Williams was playing, it can be deafening at times. Mm. And that can be very intimidating if it's not in your favor.
Right. And this stadium is called Arthur Ashe Stadium, and he is the first African-American to reach the semis since Arthur Ashe. So there's quite a significance there.
Yeah, it is very significant. It's significant, you know, for American tennis as a whole, which has not had a semifinalist at the U.S. Open in, I think, 16 years, hasn't had a winner of the U.S. Open or any Grand Slam title in 19 years. And it's incredibly significant for, you know, Black Americans, too, especially, you know, Black American children have had the Williams sisters to look up to, and they spawned really so far two generations of stars, because you're seeing, you know, Coco Gauff, now 18 years old, sort of ready to take over the mantle from them. But Sloane Stephens won this tournament a few years back. You know, they've had a number of people, but Black men who have really so many lucrative sports options, whether it's the NFL and NBA, they're just much more less likely to pick up a tennis racket. It's just a much more inaccessible sport. Mm. So this is a huge, huge moment for, like I said, both American tennis and for Black American tennis.
Right. And I think I misspoke. I said the first African-American. I meant the first African-American man to reach the semis since Arthur Ashe. And as you said, that is significant in that there aren't that many Black American men playing tennis.
Right. Like I said, there's a lot of options, and it's a really hard sport. And there's a reason that you see so many children of former professionals playing, because you really need to start early and have a kind of singular dedication to it from a pretty early age, in a way that, you know, there's a lot of kids who are still playing football and basketball at 14, 15 years old.
Right. Okay, let's move on to the women. And the number one seed, let me pronounce her name correctly, Iga Świątek from Poland. Tell us about her, and is she the favorite to take it all?
You know, she is a terrific player, you know, is still getting better every year. She won 37 straight matches earlier in the year. She's a French Open champion, two-time French Open champion at this point, already at her young age. She's not playing great right now. You know, she's getting a little better with each tournament. She's not crazy about the kind of tennis balls they use at this tournament. She has a lot of spin in her game, and she's having trouble controlling it. She's also having a little trouble controlling her head, because it seems like she's thinking about the balls too much instead of just hitting them. She's another terrific player to watch. Seemingly has a great head on her shoulders, has done a tremendous amount of philanthropy work for Ukraine in the last 6 months, and, you know, is poised to be a really good ambassador for the sport over the coming decade, if she can, you know, avoid the pitfalls that so many players are unable to avoid, you know, the mental struggles and the strain that this sport puts on so many people.
We have a few seconds left, but you mentioned the balls, and there are different balls for men and women at the Open. Why is that?
Well, supposedly the WTA Tour wants it that way. They choose these balls that are supposedly play a little faster and are lighter, and some of the women like it that way. Some of them don't, and the ones who don't have been complaining aloud about it a lot lately, and TBD in terms of what balls they use next year.
Okay, great. Well, Matt, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming on the
show. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. Matt Futterman, sports writer for The New York Times. Coming up, the director Kevin Smith is here. He has made a third Clerks movie based on his real-life heart attack.
When you're creative, you know, the idea of death is repugnant, because you're like, what? I'll stop and not make a Clerks movie? Ridiculous.
Our conversation is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's been nearly 30 years since an aspiring filmmaker named Kevin Smith scraped together around $27,000 to write and direct his first feature film, Clerks, the tale of two friends one working at a convenience store, the other working next door at a video store.
You like to think the weight of the world rests on your shoulder, like this place would fall apart if Dante wasn't here. Jesus, you overcompensate for having what's basically a monkey's job. You push f***ing buttons. Anybody could waltz in here and do our jobs. Christ, you work in a convenience store, Dante, and badly, I might add.
Well, that little black and white flick would make around $3 million and launch Kevin Smith's career. He went on to make Mallrats, Chasing Amy, Zach and Mary Make a Porno, and lots of others. Fans, though, never let go of Clerks. So there was Clerks 2, and now Clerks 3 hits select theaters on September 13th.
I need an ambulance at the Quick Stop!
Saved my life, man. Wish I had a life worth saving.
What are you talking about?
Sit around and watch the same movies over and over.
I always thought you could have made a cool movie.
You're right. I'm living on borrowed time. No more watching movies.
I'm gonna make a movie!
Okay, joining me now is writer, director, producer, and actor Kevin Smith. Hello.
Thank you so much. I heard that we bleeped out the F word, which makes sense.
We did.
But you're allowed to say Christ on the radio?
I know. It's full of contradictions, these so FCC crazy rules. Right? Full of contradictions.
The young Catholic in me is outraged that Christ wasn't bleeped. The young, you know, Catholic who made the movie should be outraged, but he's not. But the young Catholic inside the old me, I was like, I can't believe they said that word on the radio.
Do you still have that in you, in those old rules? I know you kind of rejected the official church a long time ago.
I did. And I don't like to, you know, take it away from anybody else. If people have faith, you know, I admire them. I'm almost envious of them. But yeah, I reached a place where I was like, this stuff doesn't make sense anymore. Yeah. And the indoctrination of my youth still stays. That's a strong brand. That yeah. Catholicism, man, you can't escape it. Even if you're like, I'm done with it. It's still like buried in my DNA and whatnot.
Kind of like the Quick Stop. You Very can't much. Escape it.
See, Catholicism is the religion I was given by my parents. Quick Stop. I chose that religion.
Well, okay.
So, I chose the faith. One was a religion. The other's my faith.
Very, very good. Very well said. So this movie is about a guy making a movie about people in a Quick Stop.
Not untrue. This movie is about 90 minutes and change.
But a bump.
In this picture, we kind of go down the rabbit hole, the meta rabbit hole, in as much as Randall, the character who worked the video store in the original Clerks, played by Jeff Anderson, he has my heart attack that I had 4.5 years ago. And he decides in the movie that since he survived the heart attack, rather than sitting around and watching movies, which he's always done his whole life, he's deciding to make the story of his life, make a movie about his life set at the convenience store. So first Clerks I made back in the day was dripping with authenticity because I literally worked at that store and while I was making the movie and stuff. So when you watch it, it's an earnest film by an earnest filmmaker who wants to be treated seriously, considered as a director. And it's just so real because as soon as we turned the cameras off, I went back to work right there. Clerks 3, I don't work in retail anymore. I own retail stores.
You
so
do?
Like Jane and Silent Bob's Secret Stash is a 25-year-old comic book store, that brick and mortar place that I've owned for a quarter century. Uh-huh. And I just bought a movie theater in Atlantic Highlands right next to my hometown, the theater that my father used to take me to and then I went through all through high school. So I own the businesses now. And if an employee had said to me, like, this job would be great for the customers, which is what Randall says in Clerks, I'd be like, you're fired. Get out of here.
I know, so, it's different to be the owner, right?
Very different when you're the boss and stuff. So, you know, I can't put that kind of behind the counter authenticity into a Clerks 3 because I haven't been behind the counter in years. But what I can do is give the film the authenticity of my heart attack and then making my movie. That's where the real comes in. Clerks is very much just my life story at that point with names changed. Hmm. Clerks 3, almost a very similar idea. That's why whenever I work with Dante and Randall, it kind of tends to bring out the best in me, the most confessional stuff.
But I thought you were Dante, or Dante was you, not Randall.
I was. I've historically always been Dante. That was the way into these movies. Like, I'd written the role of Randall for me to play myself in Clerks. That's why he's got all the best jokes. But as we got close to the production, I was like, I'm no actor. I can't do this stuff. And mercifully, Jeff Anderson did it, and he defined it. It's wonderful. But, you know, there was always that piece of me that was like, oh, I always wanted to be Randall. So in Clerks 3, I kind of do get to be Randall because Randall has my heart attack and Randall makes my movie. So it took me almost 30 years, but I finally got to be Randall, kind of.
So do you want to talk about your heart attack and how that figured into this? Because in
I had a heart attack 4.5 years ago, and it was honestly the best thing that ever happened. You saved my life, made me go vegan. I dropped a bunch of weight and stuff, which when you lose weight, they never tell you this. What happens is you instantly look younger. That's all I've been getting for the last like 4 years. Like, you look young, man. And it's only because I lost weight. So that comes in handy when you're 52 years old, when people are like, you look young. I'm like, oh, well, I'm not, but thank you for that. So when I had the heart attack, I was 48 years old, 47, right? I was on the cusp of 48. You know, it was a widowmaker, threatened to like take me out. 80% of the doctor told me, just like he tells Randall in the movie, and 80% of the cases where the patient has 100% occlusion blockage like I had, the patient always dies. But the doctor is like, I'm good at my job. I'm going to save you. And he disappeared into my crotch and made magic. That's how to get to your heart. He goes up my crotch. He puts a stent in my heart. He saves my life and stuff. And then I was stuck here on this plane of existence, because when he told me that it was an 80% chance I was going to die, I was looking up at the ceiling going, oh, this is my last ceiling. This could be the last ceiling I ever look at and stuff. And, you know, I know the movie of your life is supposed to flash before your eyes, but I was like, I'm going to start it right now. I loved the movie of my life.
So you really sat there kind of reviewing everything and
I did. I thought about, it was beautiful. I thought about like how it all began. I thought about my parents. I'm so thankful that my parents, even though they didn't know what they were doing, they did it right. Like, because I was the result. My brother and sister were the result. I thought about my friends, what beautiful friends I've had, the ones that helped me make my art. I thought about all the people I made my art with. I thought about all the years I got to make stuff. And I was actually okay with dying. I was like, you know, my whole life I've been terrified of dying. When you're creative, you know, the idea of death is repugnant because you're like, what? I'll stop and not make a Clerks movie? Ridiculous. But, you know, it happens. On the table, I was sitting there going, oh, I get it. This is like high school graduation. Like, I couldn't stay in high school forever either. Eventually, you got to matriculate and stuff. And I don't know what happens next, but I know that this is done and that's okay. I'm no longer afraid of it. Hmm. It makes sense. This is natural. Wow. So I was ready to go. I was at utter peace. And then the doctor saved my life. And I was like, now I got to make more movies. So I came back to the land of living. And one of the first things I did was we made Jay and Silent Bob Reboot, which was like a total celebration of life. Like, oh my God, I'm alive. Let's make this movie. Clerks 3, it's not a celebration of life. It's a meditation on life. You know, plays with the old chestnut of no day is promised, so to speak. So it's a movie that like you're going to laugh because it's Clerks and it's a comedy. But in the third act, man, we got something special for you. Something we'd never really done before. Maybe hinted at it in Clerks 2, but Clerks 3 really goes for it. But my job in this movie is to remind you that time is short. And if you got things you want to do, putting it off is not a good idea at this age.
I assume you've seen all that jazz because what you're saying.
Oh, my God. One of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
This movie is very much like my version of all that jazz.
So without the singing and the dancing.
One day, Clerks the musical. Look, it's still as long as there's still breath in my lungs, there's going to be a Clerks something, right? So perhaps one day it will be a Clerks musical.
Well, why do you keep going back to that well?
Because it's not a well to me. It is a life spring from which all my existence flows. I love these characters because this represents the world that I would have stayed in if I'd never made Clerks. That was my life and it would have continued as such. But I kind of keep going back to Clerks because the kid who started us on this journey, young Kevin Smith, the 22-year-old Kevin Smith, who's like, oh, I think I can make a movie, even though he had no experience whatsoever, is my hero because I get to live in the spoils of that kid's one good decision that changed his entire life and turned it into my life. And that kid, only thing that kid wanted more than anything else, wasn't all this, wasn't to be like Kevin Smith, the personality. He just wanted to be considered a director. But that version of Kevin Smith, forever ensconced, stuck at Quick Stop. So I don't know. I do it to honor him.
Hmm.
Plus the money. Let's be honest. Like, you got to get paid to do something in this life. I might as well make a thing. That's how I get paid. Might as well make a thing that makes me happy. You would think that like, oh, if you're going back to Clerks, you're going to get paid. Not at all. A lot of people thought like I got rich off Clerks. I did not. Miramax bought the film for $227,000. $35,000 of it went to pay off all my credit card debts. The movie was $27,000 plus interest from the credit cards. I paid off like the cast. They'd never got paid. I paid my parents back. They had loaned me every dollar they had in the world, $3,000 so I can rent the equipment. So I was able to give them money back. Then I bought a Dodge Neon. It was a $13,000 car, man. I drove that for like 6 years until my friend Scott Mosier was like, do you know if you get in an accident, you're dying because this thing's made of plastic? And I was like, I should probably upgrade if you will. At the end of the day, when all was said and done, I was left with about 20 grand on clothes, and that went quick.
Well, speaking of Weinstein and Miramax and all that, you have said in previous interviews that they did not pay you what they owed you for a long time, the royalties.
But to be fair, if there's a list that was once published of a bunch of people that were suing them, like Jennifer Lawrence is on that list. And she had some of that sweet, like, Silver Linings
Playbook. Silver Linings Playbook, yeah.
Oh, my God. You know how much money that is? And she got screwed out of it, too. So, yeah, there were a bunch of us that got screwed out of our money and stuff. Yeah. But to be fair, that's the least egregious of all of Harvey's offenses, let's be honest.
Right. You said that you were donating some of your royalties to a women's...
I did say that. And not only did I donate, I donated all of them ever since. Every time we get residual checks, the check goes to women in film. So I think the last one we sent was, I don't know, 6 months ago or something like that.
Yeah. Oh, great. Well, so...
Isn't it?
Like, it is great. I mean,
that. You're like very casual. Like, great. Yeah, it is kind of sweet, man.
No, it is sweet. I don't mean to be enough,
and, you know, it's the least I can do, right? Like, you don't want to profit from that monster. But he did buy my movie and start my career.
And you did say in previous interviews that you, before all this came out, that he was sort of a father figure to you.
When did I ever say that? Don't put those words in my mouth. Are you kidding me?
Oh, I have it here. This is from NPR, actually.
Go ahead.
The relationship I had with Harvey was definitely more like that father-son relationship that you read about in literature and whatnot. I love him to death.
Father-son relationship, not father figure.
Okay.
Big difference. Big difference to a man of words. Yeah. Obviously, you could see how triggered I was by father figure. I never would have said that. But a father-son relationship, as in literary, I could pass with that. In as much as I didn't like him. Most sons don't like their fathers.
Well, you say I love him to death, but yeah, I definitely had some issues along the way.
Yeah, well, I was appreciative of the fact that I have a career. Like, without that dude having Miramax, nobody buys Clerks.
Right.
But, you know, I left before everything went south. I was as shocked as everybody else when I read the New York Times. Like, what? Yeah. And people are like, how could you not know? I'm like, you know any rapists that tell you what they do all the time? That confess over conversation or dinner? Obviously not. Villains like to keep that work in the dark. We didn't know any of that stuff. But when I left in 2008, I was already at a place where I'm like, I don't like these people anymore.
So let's talk about what you're doing next, because I think that you're releasing your next movie as an NFT. Can you explain that?
The good folks at Secret Network, and they're a blockchain a company that is built on building blockchain privacy. Those cats acquired the movie and then released it to kind of show people that their technology is very private and very foolproof. A lot of people are like, oh, you're just going to right click, save it, and everyone can take that movie. But it hasn't been bootlegged yet. And I think Secret was very happy with the whole thing. So they're like, see, it's exactly as we said. I followed Quentin into business with them. Quentin had sold Pulp Fiction, the script, as an NFT version of the script that had never been published. He did it with Guy and Secret Network. And so that's how I met him.
How do people see it if it's an NFT?
It's just not a physical thing, obviously. With home video, you could buy a DVD or a Blu-ray. With the NFT, you open it and it brings you to the movie. It's its own piece of artwork in and of itself. And then it's also a key to the movie and all the extras and stuff like that. It's really kind of wonderful to do and historic, and as much as we were the first.
Yeah, it sounds really cool. So I guess explain it to me, because I'm really thick about these things. It sounds like a link that you would get and click on a link.
It does feel very much like, oh, there's a link and it gets you to a movie, but that's not what it is at all. And I know that Guy would be cursing me out if I was like, yeah, it's a link, because it's not. So much security built into it. But I'm not trying to sound condescending or mansplaining, but it's the way I understand it, and I can't even say it back to you, it's a lot more complicated than clicking on a link.
Okay.
But between us, you know, Luddites, sound like that.
We're in the same generation, so I feel like it's a little like learning a new language
and not remembering
what you just learned.
It's easier to remember when there's like money on the line, you know, like I made money off it. So, of course, I'll always remember.
All right. So Clerks 3 runs through Fathom Events, which means it's like an event, I suppose.
There's two ways that Clerks 3 is being disseminated to the public. One is the Fathom Event screenings from September 13th. To the 18th. It was supposed to be September 13th to 15th, but our pre-sales were so big, the Fathom was like, we're going to open it up for 6 days. So we get a weekend this time, which is amazing. But the other way to see it is I head out on Sunday. We start the convenience tour, which is where I go city to city with the movie, watch it with you, and then we Q&A. We hit like almost every state.
Wow. You're a busy man.
Like, I don't have the luxury of being Chris Nolan, where the audience will seek you out and find you. I'm not a Marvel filmmaker where the audience will find you no matter where you are. I got to go to the audience in some cases. The money is important for the people that finance the movie, but I do this just for the love, just for the, like, be in that room and feel all that energy of people like digging on the work and then doing the Q&As and stuff. Like, that to me is everything. So yeah, there's two different ways to see it. One without me and one with me.
Okay. All right. Kevin Smith, his new movie, Clerks 3. You all heard where you can see it, September 13th through the 18th. If you want to see it at Fathom Events, get your tickets through them. Kevin, thank you.
Thank you so much. And KCRW, I will KCRW you later.
Okay. Coming up, we'll have your weekend movie reviews next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Thursday, so you know what that means. It's time to look ahead to the weekend's new movie releases. We have two excellent guests to do that with us. Sean Edwards, award-winning journalist for Fox 4 News in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Sean.
Hey, how you doing?
And William Bibbiani, film critic for The Wrap and co-host of the critically acclaimed network. Hi, Bibbs.
Good afternoon, Madeline.
Okay, let's begin with Barbarian. It's a horror movie about a woman who finds out the rental home she booked is double booked.
Why don't you just crash here?
Oh, no.
I don't know if you got a great look at this neighborhood, but I don't think you should be out there by yourself. It's dry and there's a lock on the door.
By the way, I'm Keith.
Tess.
You take the bedroom and I'll sleep out here on the couch.
Yeah. Okay, Sean. I mean, what is she doing? Why didn't she run away into that bad neighborhood? Because, boy, that doesn't look good.
Well, if she runs away, we won't be on your show because there wouldn't be a movie and there wouldn't be anything to talk about.
That's right. Okay. What happens after she decides to accept his invitation?
Okay, let me start with this first, because this is tricky, because every now and again, a movie comes along where you just don't want to say anything about it, because even revealing the synopsis pretty much gives away too much and spoils all the fun. With that said, I do recommend that you watch this film without talking to anyone about it. And this kind of sounds weird, but not listening to any reviews about it and definitely watching it with an audience would be best. This movie's full of jump scares and titanic surprises, but it's as scary as it is funny, but it's the social commentary that this film delivers that often slashes the most. Barbarian is one of the best horror movies I've seen in a long time. It's actually one of the best movies of the year. I'm not saying it's perfect. There are a couple of moments that drag a little bit, but it's really hard to talk about the flips and the twists because it will literally give everything away.
Okay. Well, you talked a lot about it, but I mean, it sounds good to me. You're right. I don't really have a sense of the plot, but maybe that's exactly the point.
That is exactly the point, because once things start going, it's very sharp. It's well done. It's well executed. It's just that, you know, to be fair, this works if you don't know anything about it, but it is a great representation of the horror genre.
All right. Barbarian is in theaters in wide release. Moving on, something we do know the plot of, it's Pinocchio, directed by prolific and award-winning filmmaker Robert Zemeckis. It stars Tom Hanks as Geppetto.
Star light, star bright. First star I see tonight. I wish I might have the wish I wish tonight.
When you wish upon a star.
Okay, Bibbs, we have all seen this movie in the past. What is new about this one?
Well, now it's really bad.
So this is the latest in Disney's live action remake cycle. They usually hit most of the major bullet points, but they like to mix it up a little bit just to make it feel like there's actually a reason to go to the movie. In this case, all the changes are bad. They managed to just completely miss the point of everything. And I think the perfect example of this is there's a bit in the middle, everyone knows, where Pinocchio lies. And when he lies, his nose grows. And it's like, aha, lying is bad. That's the lesson. Yeah. And then the blue fairy comes in and says, all right, you learned your lesson. Here you go. And now you can get out of this cage in which you've found yourself. And in this version of the movie, lying is actually the only way to get out of that cage. So that's how he like is able to like get a key with like his really long nose. And I'm like, so you're telling me that the point of this scene, which is supposed to be that lying is bad, is now that lying is the superpower. And I'm like, all the movie feels that well thought out. Like, all the changes are either arbitrary or completely missing the point of the original or any kind of relevance it could have now. And yeah, pretty much nothing about it works except some of the minor, the smaller performances are rather good. Keegan-Michael Key is good as always. Cynthia Erivo plays the Blue Fairy. She's amazing in everything. She can sing incredibly. But yeah, aside from some of those smaller performances, everyone is off their game in this movie. Nothing works.
Sean, lying as a superpower, that seems to be the way it is these days in real life. What did you think of this one?
Yeah, that was a great line. Lying as a superpower, because it is one of the biggest flaws in the movie. And I'm not sure who asked for all these new versions of the classic tale, but this is the first of the second this year. This one's the version with Tom Hanks as Geppetto. And the sad thing about his performance is we are now actually witnessing Tom Hanks's retirement plan. his performance in this thing was like,
is it worse than Colonel Tom Parker and Elvis? That's all I want to know.
Yes.
Wow.
This feels like Tom Hanks is playing Geppetto at a kid's birthday party and only like one third trying.
But it's the type of kid birthday party that you would have like at a Chuck E. Cheese, and you hired this guy to come and entertain. But the problem is it's neither inventive or charming. Like, why make this if you're not going to improve on the original? The version this is based on came out in 1940. You had 80 years to make this better, and you didn't.
Oof. Okay. Pinocchio is streaming on Disney Plus beginning today. Next up, an action movie about a real-life Czech military commander. The movie is called Medieval.
I will do whatever it takes to kill her. I will burn every tree. I will burn every man.
Her uncle is the King of France. You must protect her.
Argus! Tomorrow, she will be yours.
Now!
What about Žižka?
Okay, Bibbs, this stars Ben Foster and Michael Caine. Tell us about this movie and the plot.
Okay, so Medieval, it's being touted as the most expensive movie in Czech history, and it is about a real-life Czech military commander who is rather the stuff of legend. In addition to allegedly never losing a battle in his entire career, he kind of like invented the idea of the tank. Like, he's a big deal in like warfare history. So here he gets his own movie. He's played by Ben Foster. In this movie, it's sort of an origin story of him. He's a mercenary working for Michael Caine, for a king who has a claim to the throne of the Holy Roman Emperor. And so he gets enmeshed in a whole bunch of stuff. He ends up having to kidnap the niece of the King of France, and they go on the run and they're being attacked by everybody. There's two things going on in this movie. On one hand, it's an action movie. And as an action movie, it's pretty cool, actually. There's a lot of really brutal fights. You get a really good sense of military strategy from a lot of it. On the other hand, there's all of this political intrigue, and it all just gets super in-depth and kind of hard to follow really, really fast. It's like, oh, is King Sigismund gonna fight Lord Rosenberg? Oh no, wait, is Rosenberg the guy who tried to have Michael Caine killed? And it's so easy to get lost in all of these really intricate historical details that frankly don't have our emotional interests at all. What we really care about is Ben Foster. And whenever Ben Foster is on screen, it's a really cool action movie. Whenever he's not, it's a pretty boring historical film. So it's a bit of a mixed bag.
So it's a little bit Game of Thrones, a little bit PBS miniseries.
That's a fair thing. No? I think it's a fair assessment, yeah.
Sean?
Well, the problem with Medieval is the film's scope and scale is diminished by confusion and bewilderment of the story. Because like Bibbs just said, I needed a roadmap to figure out literally what was going on. I didn't know who was who. I didn't know who was doing what. But once they started fighting, I was okay. I mean, this is actually probably one of the rare films you'll watch where if you just turn the sound off and watch the action sequences, it's actually really entertaining. I thought the action sequences were entertaining. I think the problem, though, is this movie clearly wants to be a big boy blockbuster. It just wasn't quite there. You can see what they were trying to do, but the execution just didn't work. Now, Ben Foster's amazing. I don't know how Ben Foster gets trapped in so many bad movies, but he's a great actor, and I can watch Michael Caine all day. I thought Ben Foster and Michael Caine were interesting. I just didn't know the journey their characters were on, because it's a historical piece of history that I'm not familiar with, but the movie doesn't do a good job of laying it out. So I literally had to Google in real time, you know, what's going on? Who are the people? Who are the players? What are they doing? So it's like the filmmaker set out on this journey to create these great action pieces, but had no script. Like, it's literally impossible to follow.
Okay. Medieval in theaters in wide release today. Finally, an action thriller called End of the Road, starring Queen Latifah as a recently widowed mom trying to protect her family.
Mom, are we homeless people?
As long as we're together, none of us are ever homeless.
Everybody just get some sleep. We got a long day ahead of us on the road tomorrow.
Somebody throwing a party or something?
No, this sounds like a fight.
Okay, Sean. They're on a road trip and bad things happen. What are these bad things?
Well, the bad thing is they are witnesses to a murder. But I just want to say it's nice to know that we now live in a world where on the eve of the 50th anniversary of hip hop, rappers who are now known more for acting than rapping can actually make the same type of crappy, unfunny movies that Adam Sandler, Jack Black, and Melissa McCarthy made years ago.
It's true equality what it is what you're saying.
It's true because, look, Queen Latifah and Ludacris, who are two former rappers who sometimes dabble in rapping on occasion, they star in this movie that's neither funny or thrilling. So calling it a comedy thriller seems like a really weird definition. Because what happens is the beginning is set up perfectly because Queen Latifah, she recently lost her husband. She has two kids. So you think you're about to watch this movie where her life is about to go into transition because she just lost her home in Los Angeles. She's about to move to Texas for a new start. They load up the car. There's this beautiful, like, playlist playing with this great music. I'm like, oh, I want to be on a road trip with Queen Latifah because her and Ludacris have great taste in music. And you think you're about to get this introspective type movie. Then all of a sudden, it just turns into this dumb, cliched, laden film populated with drug cartel members, a stereotypical Texas sheriff, neo-Nazi trailer park dwellers, unconvincing car chases that all ends in a thud. Then you get this brief return to that introspective start that was unfortunately abandoned to service the lowest common denominator of viewers, which is what Netflix has began to do very often.
Oh boy. Bibbs, did you like it any better?
I liked it a little better. I think Sean is right. A lot of this movie is just, you know, not up to scratch. But I also feel like it's not a comedy that turns into a thriller. I think it's just a somewhat amiable family introduction to this family that leads into a pretty middle of the road thriller. But I can't be too angry at middle of the road thrillers. I grew up watching a lot of B movies on like Turner Classic Movies where they would just be like, yeah, we'll have the really cool 1950s movies and then we'll have the super cheap, very low concept kind of trashy thrillers that would occasionally be better than you thought. This feels like just a standard programmer. We have an interesting cast. Queen Latifah and Ludacris, they carry the film as best they can. They go through a lot of the motions. It's basically just an excuse to kill some time while watching television. I think as a time killer, God knows I've seen worse. And I think that's okay that that's the function of cinema sometimes. It's just there to be mildly entertaining. And you know what? I was mildly entertained.
Really? Nothing happened?
You know what? I've seen worse. I can only be so mad at this. I can't work up any animosity towards it because I don't think it's anything other than, oh, so Queen Latifah paid for her garage this week. Like, they got a new garage And they
Oscar nominee. Yeah.
And a lot of talented actors make junky films. Yeah.
Look, Queen Latifah, Tom Hanks, they have bills to pay, you guys.
They obviously have a lot of bills to pay. So
very fair.
All right. End of the Road streaming on Netflix if you have seriously nothing else to do. That begins tomorrow. Sean Edwards, award-winning journalist in Fox 4 News in Kansas City, Missouri. William Bibbiani, film critic for The Wrap and co-host of the critically acclaimed network. Thank you both.
Thank you, Madeline. Always a pleasure.
I appreciate it. These movies make us look dumb.
Impossible. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great weekend, and I will see you on Monday.